Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Current Affairs Radio, the current affairs podcast that gives you the current affairs audio pleasure. I am here today being Aisling McRae. I just forgot my name for a moment. I forgot to tell you what my name is. I am Aisling McRae, Podmaster General, and I am here with Business Manager Allegra Silcox.
Hello, everyone.
And Amusements and Managing Editor Leda Gold.
Hi.
And we're here today to talk about how you're interpreting media wrong. Actually, you probably aren't. You're probably doing it just as well as you could be. And any way you want to interpret media is fine. But we're going to talk about some troubling trends in media criticism and media interpretation. Hello, everyone. What do we think?
I think you're probably definitely doing it wrong. You, the audience. So... just here to stir the pot.
Yeah, please throw out all your books. You've read them wrong. Throw out all your movies, your DVDs, your Blu-rays. Do they have something new after Blu-rays? I guess it's streaming. Throw away your streams.
Cross them first and then throw them away.
But not only are you wrong, most critics are also wrong. People who are paid to talk about this are also wrong. So you should throw them out the window after you've crossed your streams. Do that too.
Yeah. Do a defenestration of Prague on anything media related, except for us.
Yeah, we're great. We're beautiful.
We're going to be correct today. Everything that we say is correct.
So the reason we're all gathered here today, I guess, is because I wrote a piece. I was hoping you guys could ask me some questions about it, because otherwise it's just me talking about stuff I wrote, and that'll be unbearable.
I have to say, so before we get into asking questions, this article, this is Satanic Panics of the Death of Mythos. It's been pretty popular. It is so fucking good. I can say it because I'm not Aisling. This is such a fucking good article. It's one of the best ones we put out, I think. And what it's about, Aisling connects a number of really interesting themes and looks at the way satanic panics partly happen because people, you know, evangelical religious people viewed things very literally, and they viewed, like, you know, they often viewed the Bible very literally and needed to, like, prove that the Bible, like, the world's created in 7 days and things like that. Like, everything there is the word of God, is literally true. And then they would see things like D&D or death metal, and they would see these things as like, they had to be literally true. People had to be literally raising demons or, like, literally believing that they were, you know, in another world or something. And so that was very dangerous. And so there's a satanic panic over it. And Aisling then connects this in such, like, clever, clever ways to the way that we look at culture now. So that's it. So that's the context. But so I want to start out by asking why you're so obsessed with satanic panics, because you mentioned that in this.
Me? I don't know. I don't know that I'm obsessed. I just...
You said you'll read anything put down in front of you that is a literal quote from the article.
Okay. All right. So I...
Listen, Aisling, first you have to admit that you have a problem. Then we can proceed to the next step.
I think I just have an interest in the fact that... So in the 80s, obviously, you have the satanic panic. And then in the US in particular, obviously, you have this rise of the religious right. And not just in the US as well. Like, you had... these new forms of religion, like you had it in Saudi Arabia as well, you had an increase, like a doubling down in terms of like Wahhabism and, you know, various fundamentalist forms of religion. And I've always been fascinated by the fact that people often think of fundamentalist views and fundamentalist forms of religion in particular as being very old, as if it's, you know, it's connected, oh, it's primitive, you know, it's taking these words that are, like, you know, thousands of years old, and it's doing things in a very, very old-fashioned way, when the reality is that these things are actually very, very modern. The rise of evangelical or fundamentalist forms of religion are often associated with new media. So television, for example, the rise of televangelism was obviously huge. You had that in, like, the Middle East as well, like TV stations kind of promoting fundamentalist forms of religion. It's often, I guess, a reaction to, you know, the moment of the time, some sort of anxiety about modernism or whatever. And I guess I just find that contrast pretty interesting. The fact that it's something that is in many ways quite new, but tries to reconnect to things that are old, but in a way that doesn't really understand or engage with that old material, that original material. So yeah, I guess that's why I'm interested.
So that older material in some ways is the mythos that you talk about in your piece. Can you talk about this difference between mythos and logos, if you want to break that out for us.
Yeah, so I borrow this term from, as I said in the article, I originally heard about it through this book I read called Dangerous Games by Joseph Laycock, which was about Dungeons & Dragons and the Satanic Panic. But he mentions in that book Karen Armstrong, who is like a sort of theologian and studies.
You said writer on comparative religion.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. So he got that idea from Karen Armstrong, who's a writer on comparative religion, who talks about this difference between what she calls mythos and logos, or mythos and logos. I don't know which one sounds cooler. The point is that...
It sounded really badass the first way, I think.
Yeah, I mean, the point is that I'm saying Greek words, so it means I'm very cool and smart.
in the accent, let's not forget.
Yeah, that's true. Logos basically refers to anything that can be reduced to, like, literal, observable, rational things, right? So this is things... like science, like observable phenomena, things that we can understand with our human brains and put into words and understand that they're to do with rules, right? So I understand, well, I don't understand because I'm dumb and I don't know anything about science. But if I look at a majestic view of a mountain, I can understand, in theory at least, that what is happening is I have these two things in my face that are called my eyes, and my eyes, you know, have lenses, and there is light that is going into my eyes, and that is transmitting signals to my brain and all of that. But the world is not just made up of things that we can understand through logos. There are also things that we can understand through mythos. Mythos is basically everything that is not reducible to something that is sort of understandable or something that you can put in words. That is things like transformative experiences, like stories, like emotion, like spirituality, like ritual, like these kind of deeper meanings. So I might look at a majestic mountain and I might understand on a sort of rational level, yes, all these things are happening with the light in my eyes, and that mountain is a product of these geological formations. But it's mythos that makes me feel like, oh my God, that's a mountain. You know, that's like, that's something I could in many ways never understand. Like the beauty of it and the fact that it's something so much bigger than myself, and the way it makes me feel when I see the like light that reflects off it and the wind and right? So that's mythos. Very scientific, very academic description that I gave there. And basically she says like religions historically that, they might have logos, they might have, you know, rules, or they might have explanations for things, but there's also mythos, right? There's also the ritual and the custom and the understanding that there's something deeper that is beyond like human understanding, right? And the thing with fundamentalist religions is that they have no use for mythos. They don't really get it. So they don't really understand that if the Bible is the word of God and it says that the earth was made in 7 days, that doesn't necessarily have to mean the earth literally was made in 7 human days that we understand by human means, right? There are a lot of different ways of understanding that. And crucially, that could still be true in a way, right? True doesn't have to mean literally true. It could be a story. It could be through something that we couldn't understand by human science, right? But the way evangelicals understand it is like, no, the Bible is true. And that means that's literally true. Like the way that the human says something is true. So that means the earth has to have been made in 7 days. And that means we need to find the science. We need to, you know, have these explanations for why, you know, dinosaur fossils are fake. We need to have a creationist museum. We need to have all these logical explanations for why, yes, of course, the earth was built in 7 days. Because how could it be true in any other way?
It's a very sad way to live your life, to think that everything's got to be like exactly literally true. Because it's actually like slightly off center, but the way people use literally in speech and figuratively in speech, like people say like, yeah, no, I literally died. It was terrible. You know, and you don't know, they didn't literally die. And there's like word pedants will be very upset that you said you literally died. You didn't literally die. You're still standing.
But literally, like, is the metaphor in the sentence.
Exactly.
Fuck off, pedants.
You're just saying, like, it was... But it's funny that we use the word literally in a metaphorical way to be, like, extremely dramatic about things. It's kind of great. It's because the way we talk about experience, we don't talk about things in strictly literal terms. to the point of being silly about the word literal itself.
Yeah, and that's good, right? Because the world is not made up of a series of literal things and events, or, you know, I don't think that it is. And that doesn't have to mean that you have to be, you know, super spiritual in some sort of formal way. That doesn't mean that you have to become like a new age guy or whatever. But as I said, like, even if you're not religious or you're not spiritual, you don't experience things in your life in this very literal minded rationalist way all the time, right? You feel special on your birthday. You have moments where you just see something and somehow it just, like, it makes you feel some way that isn't necessarily rational, right? You get excited when your sports team wins, or you just, I don't know, you see something and it makes you feel sad for no reason, or makes you feel like amazed at the world for some reason. You look at a mountain, as I said, and you feel, oh my God, the world is so big and so powerful, and it touches you in a way that rational explanations of things can't always literally touch you. Can't always meaningfully touch you, rather.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's the classic American Beauty moment. Do you ever just see a plastic bag and then cry about how beautiful the world is?
The Katy Perry moment, rather than Katy Perry better than American Beauty. So I'm renaming that.
Gotcha. But you also correctly point out that if you support a sports team, like you said, and you feel ecstatic when we, quote unquote, these players that you have never met or interacted with, you've done nothing to contribute to the team, but you feel a sense of pride when they win. But I think you also go in this article into something that stuck with me a lot. It kind of ties together a lot of thoughts I've had over my lifetime around how these types of rituals and meanings aren't just about experiencing a single moment and then having a reaction to it. It's also about the fact that if you actually try to understand your own life, for instance, I might think about my Virginia phase, my Boston phase, and my New Orleans phase of my life, or the way that we draw patterns to say, these are the certain rituals that I do on Mondays. And Monday is really just kind of a finite series of seconds that exists on this infinite timeline. But our brains can't really work that way. And we impart a lot of meaning, ritual steps that we associate with the day of the week, with a certain phase of our life. So actually, this mythos extends so deeply into our consciousness that it creates the narrative of our own lives. We really can't separate ourselves from this way of thinking and working. And I think that's really important. And a lot of us maybe try to become so rational that we miss the point here.
I was about to say, imagine a world in which the Rebecca Black song Friday wasn't as amazing. Because Friday has no meaning for us. But she captures the meaning of Friday.
Yeah. She captures the meaning. Gotta get down on Friday. Today, we are recording on a Friday, so this is particularly meaningful to us.
Allegra, I think you're right. Is it a Joan Didion line? It's like, we tell ourselves stories in order to live. Like, you have to have some kind of arc to your life, right? Some way of understanding your own life. And we don't understand our life in terms of, like, well, this thing happened and that thing happened and this factual, you know, series of seconds, of minutes, of hours happened. You can't keep all that in your head. You would go insane. You understand it as, like, you're the protagonist in this little story, right? That you went and you lived in this place and you had those, you know, maybe one or two experiences that stick out that kind of transformed you in some way or changed your life, or you learned this or you had that problem and then you moved to another place and things happened. So we understand our lives as stories, right? And it gives us meaning to not understand everything in a very literal point-by-point way, right?
Right. And yet when we turn to art criticism or reactions to art, it seems that the prevailing trend is to try and debunk all that, to demystify, to actually lay out in painful clarity how all of these things actually line up. Or more importantly, if they don't line up, it's very important for the YouTubers to tell us all the plot holes and explain what went wrong. And it's so odd that we naturally, instinctively respect sort of the themes of our own lives, that the narratives that we create, but then we must sort of pick apart the stories that other people tell us.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And so I guess that brings us to what this all has to do with media criticism and why everyone's doing it wrong.
Especially you.
Especially you.
You know who you are.
No, you're probably fine. We love you. We love all our listeners. So, tell us exactly how logos and mythos, pronounced like an annoying American, how that plays out with this contemporary media criticism? What are people doing wrong?
Yeah, so I basically, from that idea, I started thinking about bad movie criticism. And that's not criticism, not as in criticism of bad movies, but as in film criticism that doesn't really seem to get what film criticism is supposed to do. You will find this a lot in terms of YouTubers, especially. All bad things basically come back to YouTube. You get a lot of people, and I did give the caveat that, like, a lot of people on the internet are young, and it's really, really easy to forget that. Like, sometimes you see people having, like, a dumb take, or you see something that you disagree with, and it's easy to get really mad at it, but then sometimes, like, you'll see something in their, you know, in their username, you'll see, like, a date of birth, and you'll be like, oh, I'm getting mad at an actual child, an actual baby who is still... still on the tit. So, like, well, what am I doing? So I don't want to be, like, too harsh on people who are young and who maybe are still kind of coming to terms with, like, how they understand media or whatever. But I started becoming very frustrated because you would see a lot of discussion of films online in particular, but even, like, sometimes in printed media and stuff, and in supposedly more respectable outlets that basically focus very, very much on things like explaining the end of a film or explaining the plot or why this thing is an allegory or why, you know, this bad character is bad and that's problematic because you shouldn't have bad characters doing bad things. Or people in from many different angles and many different positions, some of them more understandable than others, understanding media in a very, I think, two-dimensional way, like reducing art, which I think by its nature is supposed to be go a little bit beyond what you can kind of literally experience and describe in words, and reducing it to things like these things happen in the plot, or this character does this thing and therefore this character is good or this character is bad.
You know, part of me, when you said that, Ash, thing about, you know, getting mad at children online, it extends beyond media criticism now, though, I think, because this has become such a prominent way that the masses interact with media that I feel it's affecting the large, already horrible franchises that, like, Disney owns. But an example would be people get mad about the Death Star having this really big vulnerability, right? Like, wow, the Galactic Empire really just left this hole at the top of the Death Star that you could destroy. And so Disney went and made a whole movie explaining why that you're wrong. Like, okay, yeah, you guys were right. That was a really silly mistake that we made. And we're going to fix that by making this movie called Rogue One, which is bad.
Thank you. That movie sucks.
That movie sucked. It had some potential because I loved the actress and because it could have been kind of a cool, like, anyway, nope, never mind. Loop tangent. So it's become very pervasive about the way that we create media as well, as trying to avoid these loopholes or close them in old beloved franchises instead of respecting that you could treat it more like, I mean, I hate metaphor actually, but if you think about the really loose mythos approach, the mythos approach is like, wow, this is the small vulnerability that a team of rebels were able to come together to exploit in order to win the day. But instead, we're now talking about the 2-meter hole. Ugh.
Could it be that the Empire has hubris and doesn't look for small vulnerabilities? Could that be a metaphor for how they behave?
And also, no, it's a spy. It's a spy, Lyta.
To get to Rogue One.
Sorry. I'll let you do Rogue One in a second. Okay. Have you guys seen the Red Letter Media video where they're reading, like, the Darth Vader, the explanation of Darth Vader's outfit?
No, but I need to.
I've seen that one. I've seen a lot of Red Letter Media, but not that one.
Yeah.
I'll link it in the, I will put it in the footnotes. Yeah, it's this video of Red Letter Media, who some people might know are some good YouTube media criticism people. And they are just reading out these details of Darth Vader's costume and the exact reasons, like, how and why he came to have this particular costume with it, and nothing about, like, oh, it's the aura of menace that it brings or you know, the historical costumes that might have inspired it or anything like that. It's all like, no, it's made out of, like, this material from this planet. It's code, you know, its production code was #15Z.
Oh my God.
And the best part is explaining that after he was mutilated in the fight, and his face got messed up. He was transported to the Emperor Palpatine General Hospital.
Oh, the immolation scene.
That's spectacular.
Okay, yeah. So that's another good example. It not only affects the media that these large companies are making now, it also affects the way that the communities interact, because the more lore that you know is a major gatekeeping mechanism. I'll speak for nerddom because that's kind of the culture that I know best. But, you know, if you say that you like Star Wars, only a really big asshole, but they do exist, but will say, oh, so how many parsecs did the Millennium Falcon do the Kessel Run in? I'll be like, first off, it's 12. Before you ask your follow-up, I know that it's a measure of distance, not time. Fuck you. But there is some element of that, that they'll gauge, okay, are you one of the people who just watched Star Wars and liked it? Or are you one of the people who knows all about the lore and the universe? And I know that Lyta has a lore rant.
Well, I have actually a men rant, because this is men. Like, I don't know a single woman who does this. And part of that's what the gatekeeping is to keep out, because the idea that there are casual fans who just like it because they have feelings. Like, they're specifically trying to gatekeep against women. It's not actually like, there's definitely, you know, women who analyze these things in very like logos annoying terms. But the idea of the gatekeeping and what's going on here is an attempt to do that. To very briefly rant about lore, because I've got Coleridge syndrome. I don't care about lore in stories. I'm a big sci-fi fantasy fan, but lore is just, I skip those codex entries. I don't give a shit. Like, what is interesting is the world.
I have a question. Does that, you know, when you open like a fantasy book and at the beginning there's a map?
Fucking love the maps.
The maps are good, right? So the maps, we're not including the maps in this.
You can do a map and you can do a genealogy or character list. That's it. I do not want to read, especially like in video games, but it does sometimes come up in books. You know, your codex entries where it's like, here's the history of this place. I'm like, this comes up in conversation or not at all. Like, this is within the context of the story, or I don't care. Like tits or get out. Like, seriously.
Mm-hmm. I do want to poke fun for a second and say, said the lover of Lord of the Rings, but yes.
I'm always the Tolkien defender. But the thing about the Silmarillion is an actual story. It's not just a collection of lore. It's like a big old story that is a prequel.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of all right. It's like it's totally a different kind of thing. It's not random codex entries. It's not decontextualized. It's not out of a story. It's part of the story. It's just like kind of a weirder part of the story.
Yeah, you can read the Bible of the universe of The Lord of the Rings, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
And
but
it's,
the Bible
it's enjoyable
story
to read. Yeah. Yeah,
the Bible is a story too. So I think a lot of people looked at what Tolkien did, and this happened all over the place in fantasy. A lot of people looked at what he did and they took it very literally. And they missed that it's all a story about something, and it's a metaphor about something. A metaphor about lots of things. But what they wanted to do is recreate the experience of being in that world, or the experience of reading it. So like, here's a random decontextualized factoid about this area. No one care. No one fucking care. That is not at all what the Silmarillion is. Or any of these like random little like asides that happen in Lord of the Rings. Because sometimes things just happen in conversation. And like, and, you know, it's just like, oh, it's this place. But there's no real, like, there's no like lengthy explanation of like, what's the deal with this place? It's just like, here's this cool place. It's like awe-inspiring to see it. You know, them seeing a mountain. It's like, wow, it's a really awe-inspired thing. Let's keep going.
I think people also often, because they read and gain love for these stories, whether it's books or films or whatever, a lot of people find that love when they're kids. And when you're kids, you don't necessarily know about that historical background or really like notice the thematic stuff on a, at least on a conscious level. Like most kids who read Lord of the Rings are probably not aware of the fact that, okay, Tolkien was like a philologist and he, you know, was obsessed with, you know, like Norse mythology, Northern European mythology, and also this context that he was, you know, writing in these interwar years where he had this like suspicion of industrialization and modern warfare and all that kind of thing. You probably don't know that, and you probably don't have to know that to enjoy the thing. But I think people often mistake, like, well, I didn't see that when I gained my love for this, so it's not real or it's not important. Or people, I think, get quite defensive if you point out that, like, Lord of the Rings is political or something you enjoyed when you were younger is political.
Or it's specifically, in the case of Lord of the Rings, extremely racist. Which I missed a lot of when I was younger. And then, like, it actually is, like, difficult to read good parts of it as an adult.
I think this is also part of why, like, people can get very defensive if you say like, oh, this thing is problematic because it's racist or it's sexist or whatever. Because if you have this one-dimensional reading of it, then that, I think, can sort of transfer to this one-dimensional understanding of like, oh, I enjoyed the story that's problematic, so you're saying that I'm bad. And it's like, no, you can enjoy stuff that is not like morally perfect or whatever, or you can understand things on different levels. It doesn't have to be like thing bad, so I bad.
That's actually something I wanted to ask you about, Ashlyn, because I think it's kind of the sort of next piece of these like very literal readings and people trying to like very literally interpret what's going on, not even what's going on in a story, and again, in a fun way, but just in a plot way. There's also like a conflation. We talked about this a bit in my fandom rant, but there's a conflation of the thing and the person who likes it. And like the idea that somebody who likes this thing must therefore embrace everything about it that's problematic. And it's like very complicated. And it's a way of like very easily like putting a person in a box. Do you see that as being related to logos and mythos in this way?
Yeah, I guess it is, because it's like, as I say in the piece, it's almost like people who are really, really into. And by the way, I'm not anti-law. I get the appeal of why people. I would respectfully disagree, like, no one care about law, because I do think some care.
It's true.
But care. I don't think you have to care, but I do think, like, some people are really interested in that and really enjoy that, and I think that's perfectly fine. You want to fully, like, immerse yourself in those details. But I think sometimes people, they want to treat these worlds like they're real in some way. In the same way that the evangelicals thought that, like, oh, Dungeons and Dragons is you're actually talking to, like, real demons and monsters. It's like you're saying, it's almost like it's saying, if you like Lord of the Rings and Lord of the Rings is racist, that's like you having a racist friend. Like, you're actually hanging out with the race, you know, you're hanging out with the racist orcs who are problematic.
They kind of seem like fun. They kind of seem like a good hang. I don't know, the orcs.
The orcs?
Yeah, I mean, they you know, they're cannibals, but they're you know, I feel like they could party.
Well, one conversation that Lyta and I have often when we discuss media that we've both consumed is the tendency for critics, and I also think the general public, to sort of measure media, like, art is good if it's realistic. So even if you're talking about a fantasy world, it's about those loopholes being closed, there being, like, good explanations for why the character would have done X instead of Y, you know, would they have jumped on the ship, or was there too big a gap and she was really stupid for doing that and she should have gone around the other way that was already established in the lore of the universe? So art being measured by how realistic it is, by essentially the logos side of the story, and how in the kind of society that we live in, what that really turns out to is churning out the grimdark media. So if we're measuring by how realistic it is, then we just need to have these long scenes of men just talking really grimly in the darkly lit scenes in Game of Thrones. And to me, it just feels like these things are connected, because if we are continually evaluating media in this logos manner, then it's, I think it becomes harder to make the methodic media, yeah. That's out there. And everything has to become either a direct parable, you know, allegory. It's kind of weird. It has elements of both the mythos and the logos, but the closer I can draw, like, the events of Lord of the Rings are a direct allegory to the war, which, you know, Tolkien has said he cordially dislikes allegory, but that is a very clear, definitive line that people can draw. The same thing with, I watched Donnie Darko and my friend was telling me afterwards that it was a Jesus parable, and I just freaked out. I was like, why does everything have to be a Jesus parable all the time? Don't at me about that, please. So trying to create these direct parallels, I think, is leading artists and art critiquers to focus a lot on the quote-unquote realism.
Yeah, you do see a lot of both, I think, the realism and the... You see a lot of people trying to analyze things as allegory, which, again, I think I mentioned at some point in one of a rant that I did at some point. Maybe the Star Trek one. Anyway, very few people write allegory these days. It's, like, really rare. It's just, like, not a style that's been really popular since the Middle Ages, or I guess late Renaissance, but whatever. And then these, like, wanting things to be realistic. I mean, that was like, grimdark is supposed to be, that's the response it's supposed to make to epic fantasy, like Tolkien. It's supposed to look at that and be like, you know, this is silly. Where's the, you know, where's the political economy? Where's the, you know, where are the consequences for these actions? Like, so, it, but it doesn't really play out that way because again, this is a fantasy world. So what it just sort of happens is just like, everybody's kind of miserable. This is my theory on why George R. R. Martin can't end his books. Because like, there's kind of nowhere to go with your themes if like your point is just like, well, everybody's miserable and everybody kind of sucks at everything and like can't make anything happen. You can't really go anywhere with it, the story. And then like a heroic story, you know, like more like Lord of the Rings, isn't a story that's like literally true in any sense, but it's, it is, it, it, because it is working as metaphor, it moves, it has a movement and it goes somewhere and it's like, it's giving, you know, a feeling of what things could be like, but again, not in a literal sense, just like, an, it's a feeling story. And if you're trying to write a very realistic story about how realistically one, I don't know, one king would overthrow another king, it's just like, that's just like, again, it's like history, which is like, which has been an endless cycle of like kings overthrowing kings. At a certain point, that doesn't make for interesting storytelling at all.
Yeah. I mean, it's like what we talked about before, where mythos is a way of like giving a shape of narrative to your life, right? So what you're talking about there with the sort of Game of Thrones thing of like bad thing happens, then bad thing happens, and mundane thing happens, then bad thing happens. That's like a life.
Oh my God, that's
no
the whole
shape.
Book. Yeah, that's all the books. You just did it. You just described all of them. Damn. Yeah, it is. And it is shapeless. It is without, and it's, again, I think that's why they couldn't end and why the show had such an unsatisfying ending. Because they just didn't know what to do. So it just kind of like plopped like a turd. You know, just couldn't really, because it didn't have shape, because it couldn't, you know, move anywhere meaningful.
I was going to say, I'm halfway between Lyta and Aisling on the lore, I think. I'm with Lyta that I think it's, I'm very skeptical of the trend, because I think a lot of the people who have become so deeply invested in the lore and the world building are doing it for reasons that I kind of disagree with. But I'm also someone, like, I think it's fun to know that, like, the Wookiees live on Kashyyyk and it has, like, too many Ys in it. It's fun to know. But it's really all about the intent. So if I go back to my Donnie Darko example that I said I didn't want to be questioned about, but I'm coming returning to anyway, one of the reasons that stuck out in my head is because it's one of these instances where I watch a movie and I really didn't know how to process all of it at the time. And I'm sitting there thinking, like, I could have had weeks alone with my thoughts being like, wow, like, what do I really take away from this movie? What did it mean to me? And I think it is probably a good example of a movie. There probably are lots of explainers out there about how it all worked. And having a friend immediately try to impose a meaning on me that I should be trying to draw some semblance of a one-to-one correlation allegory to the Jesus parable, it completely, in that moment, it erased my ability to interpret that media in a way that felt meaningful to me. It erased my chance to have my own mountain moment with the movie and tried to impose something that had much more structure and rules rather than allowing me to appreciate sort of the mystery and come to my own conclusions about what it meant to me instead of, you know, what they believe the creators intended with it. So I'm sad about some of the more logosy people out there who are trying to rob me of my mountain moments.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of, what's the term, like gnomic or kind of very, very, very ambiguous works people might think of, I don't know, like Mulholland Drive or something like that, where if you don't get a straight explanation, that can actually be part of the joy, because then you spend time thinking about it, like, okay, well, what did that thing mean, or what you know, how did it make me feel? I talk in the article about this web series called Pets Cop, which is basic, it's kind of hard to explain, but if people know what a Let's Play is, it's like a YouTube series where someone will play a video game, and it's a sort of video game that was created specifically for this series called Pets Cop, which at first appears to be a sort of fun kind of Pokemon, you catch these creatures game. But then as the person's playing it, they start to realize that there are some very dark things going on with this game, and there's lots of really ambiguous and creepy stuff going on with it, and there's never any straight explanation. And it's one of my favorite things because it's something I've thought about so, so many times. It ended maybe like over a year ago, a year and a half ago even. And like people still think about it. People still want to know. And sometimes you see in the fandom circles, people get very angry. When it ended, a lot of the fans were like, this is bullshit. Like, this ending was bad, and clearly the author just didn't know how to end it properly, or it was all made up, it didn't mean anything. And it's like, no, it's just because someone didn't give you a straightforward, like, this thing is X and this and Y happened at Z point, and explaining it all in literal terms doesn't mean it didn't mean anything. You wouldn't have spent like years thinking about it if it didn't mean anything.
I want to watch that.
It's
series
so good.
Bad now because of your recommendation. As soon as my mental health isn't so thin you can see light through it, I'm going in there and I'm watching that. I'm ready to be hurt. I'm ready to be hurt again.
It, you know, you need some trigger warnings and stuff because it does cover some pretty dark subject matter, but it's an incredible experience. I'd recommend it to anyone.
It's kind of the plaque on the wall in the museum that tells you like what the piece of art is. Like you look at something, you're like, that's kind of interesting. And then you look at the wall and then it's like, some pretentious garbage from the artist about what they meant. You're like, okay, well, that's what it means. And I guess I don't get to bring my own feelings to this at all. What I'm curious about, why is this happening? Do we have any theories on why this is happening now? Why is this a thing right now?
I have some theories. So you might be familiar with the No Kink at Pride discourse.
Yes.
I'm going somewhere with this, I think. So people who are not in the queer community on Twitter may not be aware of this, but every year, you know, you have Pride Month in June. Happy Pride, everyone. This might not go out in June, but you know, whatever. And every year there is this debate about whether people should be allowed to be in Pride parades in kink gear, essentially, or whether there should be quote unquote kink at Pride. And I say quote because a lot of people mean a lot of different things by that. And what you tend to see is this conversation tends to be very divided by age. So it tends to be mainly like older, like queer elders, which, you know, often that can mean just like 27 and upwards. And then like they tend to be the people who are more like pro kink because like, well, it had all these different meanings that in the queer community, because like during the AIDS crisis, a lot of queer people turned to kink as a way to like have sex, but not had to expose themselves to any risk. And, you know, there were these communities like leather communities, and there were these adult spaces that became safe spaces for queer people. And, you know, it has this meaning because it's non-normative sexuality and that's always been punished. And these are all the reasons why. And then on the other hand, you tend to have young people whose idea is like, well, it's not in the LGBTQ, it's not in any of the initials, and it's not on the flag, and I don't like it, so it's problematic, basically. It makes me uncomfortable, and therefore it shouldn't be there. And this kind of illustrates, there's a lot of stuff going on here, and the, you know, this is not a podcast about that subject. And there are plenty of people who can talk about it better than me. But I think that it illustrates this tendency now among younger people, especially this obsession with categorization and taxonomy. You see people who are very, very keen to say, well, I'm in this box and people in this box should be doing this. And these people are not real members of this community because they're doing this, or they're problematic because they express themselves in this way or that way. And I think a lot of it is to do with the internet and the fact that you can now find anything that is specifically for you. You can customize your experience a lot, and you can find people who like the same stuff you do and like it in the same way that you do. And that can create those kind of bubbles, and it can also create this situation where you don't really experience things that are not for you, that maybe make you uncomfortable, or that you don't recognize yourself in right away, or that you don't recognize, you don't fully understand right away, or things that you have to kind of puzzle over. I do think, we were talking earlier, like I said, this was like a men thing, this tendency to like be obsessed with the law and to categorize everything. And to an extent, I think that's kind of true, in that I think if you are someone who is not a like cishet white man and you're of a certain age, you sort of grew up pre-internet, I think you're kind of used to experiencing art that is not for you, or that does not immediately, that you don't immediately identify with, or that you have to kind of interpret your own way. So maybe like you're a little girl and you watch, I don't know, you get really into, I don't know, Lord of the Rings, But Lord of the Rings obviously doesn't have that many female characters. So you imagine your own world where it's like, okay, you're a girl hobbit, or you're like whatever, or you create your own characters, you kind of create your own space, or you recognize that you are
fan fiction,
right? This brings it into it. I'm very aware of the fact that I've been sort of rambling for what feels like 20 minutes now, but I think there is a divide that has been sort of exacerbated by the internet, where people, instead of having these sort of limited experiences where maybe you get certain kinds of art and you don't really know how to respond to them at first, and so you learn how to respond to things, versus this era of endless customization where you can find like, okay, I want to find, and in many ways, by the way, the fact that there is now more art available or more accessible, or communities that are more accessible to you if you're in a marginalized group, that is a fantastic thing. But I do think that there is this kind of side effect where people can find the exact thing that they want. And then as soon as they like don't quite like it, or they don't quite get it, they can move on to something else. Or they can just say, well, that's bad. And then like someone else from that same community will say, yeah, I also agree that's bad. And then you get this little bubble and you don't quite get to expose yourself to that complexity or that friction of having something that doesn't immediately connect with you. Does anything I just said in that 15 minutes make sense?
That made perfect sense.
Are you going to say the same thing, Lyda? Because I'm about to say, Lyda sent me an incredible Substack article that talked about the atomization of identity once. And I wish I could remember the name of it because it's pinging all those bells.
Yeah, that sounds exactly atomization. That's the exact thing that I mean.
And it might have been that article. And I wish I can't remember it either, unfortunately, the title of it. But this has come up before, definitely, in things I've read, that talking about like the way neoliberalism thinks about identity is it doesn't really think of people in terms of like individuals, like individual A, individual B, individual C. It's more like mini groups, like subgroups that you like marketing demographics, essentially, like really mini marketing demographics. And so to that extent, like people start to think of themselves and other people as being like little mini demographics. And like, I'm the sort of person who likes these sort of things. And then if you have David Foster Wallace on your bookshelf, that means you're this kind of person. And that's, we have like sort of these endless cycles of discourse about this, about like you're this kind of person if you like this kind of thing. And it often what it comes down to is people trying to like dismiss other people or find quick shorthands, either to find out if people are dangerous, because sometimes that comes up with like, you know, because when you meet somebody, you don't know if maybe they're trying to manipulate you or use you. So you're trying to like look for red flags or something. And sometimes people look at the media people like, which isn't maybe the best way to do it, but that's the impulse. But regardless, people are like trying to find ways to categorize other people and themselves. And one of the things that also happens along with people like trying to only seek out exactly the comfort food literature or comfort food, whatever art that they really like, people, you often actually see this in white men who are accustomed to having art cater to their needs, getting extremely upset when a piece of art comes out and isn't exactly to their needs, because they're used to being thought of as like a marketing demographic that is like being catered to, and the purpose of art is to give them what they want. And it's so like if they see like if there's like people of color in a, you know, in some kind of Disney property, they'll get like really, really mad. And like, yeah, it's because they're bigots, but it's like more specifically because they're accustomed to being cater to and not having to think about why is everybody in the story white to begin with, you know, why does it even matter if, you know, there's what difference does it make exactly to add
you think of like as a girl how many times you like watch a thing and then you play imaginary games but you just have to gender swap the characters because like all the characters were boys and you're playing with your friends who are girls, so you all pretend to be girls, but like the idea that like boys would have like female characters in a thing and they might have to like gender swap the characters so like they could be the boy version of the girl characters. No.
Yeah, I mean, and then there's like complicated things because a boy, maybe there would be like a boy who's inclined to do that, but then they would get bullied or something, you know, because you can't do that. And so, but it gives rise to people thinking that like art is supposed to, you know, it's like a shoe that you buy. It's like something you customize. It's like a customized thing you get on Etsy. It's everything is supposed to be like catered exactly to you and to your tastes, and maybe the way you've always liked it, the way things have always been, And being asked to get outside that in any way can be really, really uncomfortable.
Yeah. I think that can also happen like with marginalized demographics as well. And with that, I think it's a slightly more sympathetic thing because if you're used to not seeing yourself represented or you feel this, you know, there's this word valid, like you want to feel valid. And to an extent, that's really understandable. You want to see stories that are like you. But then it can also lead to discomfort that feels like an attack. Like there was that whole drama a year or two ago about that that story that trans woman wrote up the attack helicopter story. Mm-hmm. Basically, it's been ages, so I'm probably misremembering the details. But there was this short story that was kind of going around about this person who quote unquote identifies as an attack helicopter, which is like a transphobic meme. But it was using trans identity and kind of satirizing how that mixes with like the military industrial complex and all this stuff. And then people got really, really angry about it. And a lot of people were assuming the writer was like a cis man and was making fun of trans people. The writer was actually a trans woman. And yeah, it created this tension because people are starting to kind of, well, I say starting to, I don't think this is completely new, but art is seen as like a tool to make yourself valid or to have an experience that you want to have. You see this again with fandom where people, you know, get really like blisteringly like angry and will do harassment because like, you know, two characters got together that and they wanted the character to get together with someone else, or you know, people getting really mad that like some actor was cast and they couldn't personally see that actor as being, you know, it's troubling.
In my fandom Twitter account, the only good Twitter account that I have, I still have lots of muted words. One of my muted phrases is Ziyao troll, which is I had to mute discussion of the terrible person who goes into every fic that's written about this particular couple. And they will just completely flame you. They'll say really horrible things to the writer just because they're like, this couple shouldn't be together. It's wrong. You're problematic and terrible. This person is apparently not aware that you're allowed to simply scroll past things that you don't like. How can we make people aware of this feature of the world?
Everything needs to be catered to you at all times. You are a consumer. You are actually not paying for the experience of being online.
exactly. They're doing it for free and you're being mean anyway.
People can always like go outside. Maybe that's like the issue.
Touch
like,
that's the why grass.
It's, like, everything.
Touch the grass.
Go look at a tree. Go look at a mountain.
I posted about this once on Twitter and someone just responded just saying, I blame YA. And there wasn't really any further explanation, but in a way, like I also blame YA for this.
Okay, hit me.
I don't know. I think it's kind of weird because like, I don't... So Lida will probably know more about this than I would. I don't know when exactly YA became a common term. I became aware of it maybe around sort of when John Green was getting popular, maybe like 2015, 16, mm-hmm. not that long ago. Lida, I don't know, does YA like predate that as like an industry term? Because that's the first time I started hearing it as a common term.
It might. I'm trying to remember the way books were structured in the library because I spent a lot of time there when I was a kid. I think we had a small young adult section. It was as a genre and a brand, it's completely exploded in like I'd say the last 10 years.
Yeah. I blame more Twilight for that.
Twilight is responsible. Harry Potter is responsible. Basically, there were all these blockbusters in these genres that were really written for teenagers so they could be enjoyed by other people. And it's caused a lot of really creepy conformity and just really just horrible incentives. And but Ashley, finish your thought.
I think the reason I find it, and again, I don't want to yuck anyone's yum, right? So I don't want anyone to feel attacked or to feel like, I know we said at the beginning, like you're doing media wrong. Like I think people can enjoy media in whatever way they choose. This is just my feeling about some more general trends. But I feel like when I was young, there were definitely some books I read that were for teenagers. I really liked The Princess Diaries when I was a kid.
Aww. Hell yeah. You wrote another great book that I love that I talked to Light about last week.
What book is that?
All American Girl by Meg.
Yes, Hibbert. I love that book.
And the sequel talked about like girls how to use the tub for masturbation. I was like, wow.
Yes, I remember that. I remember that. But I don't remember there being like a young adult transition stage. I remember reading kids' books, and then sort of maybe around, like, I don't know, 11, 12 or something, reading grown-up books. And, you know, I didn't always get every grown-up book, or, you know, maybe I didn't kind of appreciate it fully or anything, but I don't remember needing to have this, like, special category. And I sometimes think, like, if I had been reading, you know, if I had been sort of 10, 15 years younger, would I have just read YA as a teenager? Because I don't know. I want people to read things that are not necessarily aimed at them, I guess.
Well, I'll just say my experience is that I was always, like, the target audience for YA. I don't know if it was called, I think it was called that back then, unfortunately. But in my high school year, so I graduated in 2009, so like the five, six years preceding this, I remember going into the Barnes & Noble. There was like the cute children's section that had a little wall, and all the YA books were on the other side of the wall. So you could go in and you could see all the Meg Cabots and all of the Twilight and Twilight knockoffs in that place. And I shopped a lot in that section because I like sci-fi, but I didn't like hard sci-fi. And I found that, like, if I tried to go into the aisle that my brother shopped in, it was just a lot of stuff I didn't mostly care about, with the exception of some of the Star Wars novels where, like, a Lady Jedi fell in love with one of the clones in the clone army, and that was a great book. And then my mom gave me a lot of romance. So, you know, I started on Nora Roberts and some of that stuff. But it is quite difficult.
I remember, sorry, can I just say, I remember, yes, Nora Roberts. I remember reading one of them when I was on holiday. It was, like, one of my mom's. And it was, I remember distinctly that the love interest, the guy, was called Gull Curry.
What?
Like, best, like, name ever. I don't think a Gull Curry would be very tasty. I feel like they'd be tough, you know, they'd be gamey. Continue.
Yeah. No, that's it. And this goes into, I recently had a big rage tweet the other day about how publishing is all wrong for everything it does for genres and what it thinks about marketability. And I learned something really interesting from a Lindsay Ellis YouTube video about publishing, that if you ever go into the Barnes & Noble or some bookstore and you see at checkout, there's this like knitting book and it's just like knitting and it has like actually needles next to it. And you're like, you sit there and you think, who out there in the world sat down and was like, I'm going to write this like really specific knitting book and it's going to have all these little extra things packaged in it and then I'm going to sell it. I'm like, who is writing this? And it turns out there's these packaging companies and the bookstore will literally say, we want to have like an origami book that we're just going to put next to the checkout counter and like, will you go make it for us? But they do this for more books. So The Vampire Diaries, which is actually a very popular series of novels and a television show, was one of these because the publishing industry said, Twilight's doing great. We need to have our own version of Twilight. And they will just hire. So it's not a ghostwriter. Like, the writer is credited on the front of the book, but they might not have ownership to the intellectual property. And they're just basically commissioning works that they think will sell. And while obviously that can have some good results, lots of people really love The Vampire Diaries, this is really fucked up. You should just let artists make the art that they like. And then I understand that you're a business and you do have to make sure it will sell, but I will read the books that you're not publishing. Publish good books that have like YA heart, but are, you know, written for adults. Please, please.
Yeah. I think this is like a broader problem. You see this with TV and movies as mm-hmm. well, where executives, like, they want to follow the trend. But the thing is, the paradox is that the thing that starts the trend is not part of a trend, right? So you have, right, like, oh, this thing gets really popular. It's a, I don't know, yeah, Twilight, for example. Okay, it's like this, you know, young, moody, like, romance that's also Mormon and it's got vampires, right? That's not, obviously, that, you know, I'm sure there were things that preceded it, but that was the new thing, and then people are really attracted to it because it's new and it has all these different elements that somehow like work together to make something great. You know, maybe not great for everyone, but it's great for a lot of people, and that starts a trend, and then you get The Vampire Diaries and whatever else, because then everyone's chasing the trend. But it's like, the things that follow the trend are not going to be as popular. You need to find the great things. You need to find the thing that will start the trend, right?
Yeah, and that's kind of what has been happening in YA and why it's exploded as a genre, and also why it's just like so manipulative. Because it'll always be like, they want the next Harry Potter, they want the next Hunger Games. And so they kind of will grab, either they'll commission, or very often they just sort of, you know, people pitch their little hearts out with the books that they really care about. And, you know, publishers will grab it or not, and sometimes try to package or sell things as if they're the next big thing. And sometimes those things fall flat. Numbers are very interesting in publishing because it's very unclear a lot of the time what has actually sold well and what hasn't, because, like, you know, print rent, you know, it gets complicated with how much is bought. This is very confusing with right-wing publishing, because, like, right-wing books often don't sell that well. It's just that, but they're like, these big print runs get bought out, so they look really popular.
It also really depends on what the publisher believes will sell and how much money they'll put into marketing it, right?
So that's, like, ultimately, like, and it's a problem because, like, it's the U.S. in particular is such, like, a meritocracy-believing country, and people really believe that if they get something published, especially, like, through the YA sphere, that, like, they're really good, that they've written something that's, you know, people are really going to want to read. And there's there was a really heartbreaking piece that a lot of people in YA publishing got really mad about. Let's see if I can find it for the footnotes, but it was a woman who, you know, she'd sold her YA novel and was happy about it, and then found that she had, like, no marketing support at all. So her books didn't sell very well. And she was just, like, really, really upset, because she's like, I thought this was, like, my moment. And then, like, it was actually just, I was just like another fish in the sea that they were just sort of tossing out there. And it didn't do well enough at first. So there was, like, they sort of, you know, cut her loose, and that was it. And that's, like, I think a lot of the time, like, why YA Twitter is so vicious and what's going on there, and why writers are so mean to each other, is there's this just intense competition to be the next big thing. And intense jealousy and intense pressure, and it leads to, like, just like a bad vibe, just a stew of bad vibes, and it sucks, because
I can see that happening, especially with YA, because I feel like, at least with can put an echo on this literary fiction. there is at least an idea that if you publish a piece of literary fiction and it doesn't sell well, you can at least be like, oh, I'm like a starving artist thing. But there's this idea, I guess, maybe I'm not helping this, but this idea that with YA, it's kind of lesser, or it's not, like, the only way to be successful in YA is to be a big thing. You can't really be like a starving artist, YA artist. Does that make
sense?
Right,
right. You've made it as a YA novelist when your thing gets picked up by Netflix and made into a TV series.
Yeah.
Like, it's not even just even, like, selling lots of books and having lots of fans. It's like the next, like, it's being a franchise. That's a real issue.
Yeah, there was a recent tweet that I think Lyda and I both freaked out about by @Steve Zizok. I don't know, we can maybe link it. It said, literary fiction is just being chill about some big dramatic things, or being super dramatic about pretty chill things. And I was like, wow, read the whole genre. And this is probably still, like, parallel, not super intersecting with the kind of the theme of this podcast, but really does make you think, like, the way that we put things into these categories is the example of trying to, like, logos the world. So trying to say, like, well, what makes it literary? Like, what if you actually think about what the definition of the genre is, it's not really about, like, the type of story, the type of setting that it's in. It's just somebody trying to stamp it and say, 20 years from now, they'll study this as a classic, stamp on the book. And it really distorts our idea of what is art versus what is, like, commercially produced YA fiction, and changes the way that we try to interpret the work at all.
Yeah. I think a lot of literary fiction that gets a lot of buzz is just kind of YA for grown-ups.
Oh!
Give me an example.
So, like, I don't want to name any names, because, like, probably maybe about 2 years ago, I started signing up to a lot of websites that did, like, literary reviews. So, you know, like, I don't know, The New Yorker, or, like, LitHub, which is, like, a popular sort of website that amalgamates a lot of pieces about the publishing world and literature and reviews of new books and stuff, so that I could kind of keep abreast of, you know, what the hot new books were, what I should be reading. And off the back of that, I read a lot of books that would get these rave reviews from a lot of people, and they would be, you know, this is revelatory, this is, you know, wonderful, this is mind-blowing. And most of the books I read that got that kind of praise were fine. There was a lot of stuff that was, you know, perfectly enjoyable, but definitely had a style that was common to them, where it was, like, a little bit lyrical, but not too much.
MFA style.
MFA, Iowa style, right? That's definitely a real thing. I remember this phrase. I cannot remember. Maybe it was Joyce Carol Oates. It was some some literary person on Twitter. I'll see if I can find who it is. And they got a lot of shit for it, but the phrase, maybe they were a little bit harsh, but it stuck so much in my head. They said that the publishing world was filled with one little autofiction, which is such a good descriptor of like a certain kind of book. Yeah, it was Joyce Carol Oates. She said one little husks of autofiction.
Such a burn.
And, you know, maybe that's harsh, but I do kind of think there's a point. There's a certain style of thing that you see again and again and again. And it sucks. I think it especially sucks for marginalized writers because there's often a tendency for publishers to seek out books that are from marginalized groups, but who are only telling certain stories and in a certain kind of way that frankly, that they think they're going to sell to, you know, white people on the Upper East Side. And that's a shame because, again, it brings it back to like that you have to see stories in a way that is beyond what you would necessarily expect, right? If someone wants to tell, I don't know, like a queer story or a story about their experiences as a person of color, but they want to do it through some sort of magical setting or a fantasy setting, it's like, oh no, that genre, that's yeah, a different thing. But if you tell a story in a way that certain kinds of literary magazines like, then that's, you know, that's brilliant, that's amazing, and we'll sell that and say that you're the like best writer that's ever lived, and then we won't bother to, you know, your second book will get like no press and there won't be a third.
This has got to be some sort of echo chamber within the circles of people who write blurbs and write the reviews in the New York Review of Books or whatever, because it reminds me of what I learned about the Oscars at some point, which is that like the Actors Guild is who actually nominates or votes, right? So I had no concept of anything about this. I've never followed movie awards. But I read saying that the reason that Oscar picks all sort of seem the same, it's like the literary fiction version of movies, is that if you have only a pool of like actors voting, then they're going to pick the same type of movie, something very character focused, something that is a good project for an actor to flex on. So all of these Oscar picks are like sad war movies that have like long pans on a sad face of an actor. And I was like, wow, what? And literary fiction feels the same to me. Like if an MFA writer is who's voting for it, then they want the same type of autofiction, which I actually only learned what that meant a couple of weeks ago. So maybe we should define it for the dumb listeners who are like me. Not dumb. You're not dumb listeners. You're perfect. You're wonderful.
I guess autofiction, it's funny, like the Joyce Carol Oates line hit so hard because that is literally the style I was taught to write in creative writing school. Like I did a creative writing major at Oberlin. That was the style. I mean, they didn't call it that, but they should have. The idea is it's especially the style that women are supposed to write in. Women and marginalized people kind of more generally, but maybe women in particular, that you're supposed to write about yourself in a very like bleh, weak, kind of meh kind of way. If you're a man writing in that style, so the character is not literally you. The character is an alter ego. The protagonist is not you. They just have had your entire life experience, and they're exactly like you, but it's not you. Okay, and anybody who tries to look at that is just doing art criticism wrong.
Yeah, you were Lyda Gold. You wrote a piece. You wrote a story, but it didn't happen to Lyda Gold. It happened to Laura
Silver.
I for real was in a creative writing class once where a girl had written a story about her best friend and being in love with her best friend. And like, Oberlin's a small school, we all knew each other. So we all knew who this best friend was, but we all had to be like, yeah, so your protagonist is in love with her best friend, who isn't Carrie Beth, even though we all knew it was Carrie Beth. Because like the names were different, but like we all fucking knew. And it was like the most awkward critique ever.
Creative writing class is now just you awkwardly saying, so like if I had a dream about a friend, and in the exactly. dream, the friends. It's crazy because, I mean, I've already talked with Light about this a lot, but my experience in creative writing workshops were like, I wanted to write in some like fucked up, some Douglas Adams shit, you know, and they're all out here and it's just, you know, Virginia Woolf wannabes. And I'm like, and you're really made to believe that that's not a valid way of writing.
And it's not even like the depth or the breadth of somebody like Virginia Woolf, because you're not supposed to move through time and space like the way that she does. It's a much like, and you know, men do autofiction too, but it's usually like descriptions of them being like total assholes to people. Sorry, not them. Their protagonist is being a total asshole for pages. And that's deep. And, you know, it's funny because there's been a recent move. This actually kind of brings us kind of back to the logos and mythos thing. There's been a recent move in literary fiction to sort of bridge over to genre fiction. You see literary writers writing fantasy or sci-fi, but they will often couch it very carefully in interviews to be like, no, this isn't, it's a metaphor. You know, the dragon's a metaphor. This is a story about this apocalypse.
This isn't like sci-fi. This is political.
Yeah, exactly. Like, what do you think sci-fi is? And it's, if you want to see a beautiful takedown, there is, Ursula Le Guin ripped Kazuo Ishiguro's book, The Buried Giant. She ripped it to shreds because she felt that he was doing, like, fake fantasy in it. And also because in interviews, he was like, oh, yeah, you know, the dragon's not, like, really a dragon. Or he said something like that anyway. And it's bullshit. Like the whole idea, especially with sci-fi and fantasy, these are all metaphors about reality, is how she puts it. Like, this is, of course it's a metaphor. You don't need to go and change the view and be like, actually, this is, I don't think the dragon is real. Like, don't worry, I don't think the dragon is real. But, like, it's supposed to be, the you know, within the context of the story, your dragons or your robots or whatever are real. But, no, they're not, like, real. We know that you don't think that they're literally true, like, literally happening. And we all know it's a metaphor, but there's so much fear of being mistaken for, like, an unserious person who might actually believe in mythos that you have to, like, couch it and be very clear, like, oh, no, I know it's a metaphor.
Ashling, am I crazy, or did you have an incredible tweet that had me rolling that was sort of describing this type? Yes, the answer is definitely yes. There's something about, like, making fun of these sort of Oscar bait movies that just have, like, the sad protagonist in the middle of a divorce leaning against their kitchen counter or something. And I was just like, yeah, I don't, like, there's no shade against this type of
I don't remember movie that specific or book. Tweet. I don't know if that was me.
I'm sure you had something equally valid to say about it at some point. You should all follow Ashling on Twitter. It's all gold. But just, like, I just don't necessarily want to watch that stuff all the time. And I don't want all of the money and all of the kind of prestigious trappings that some of these types of movies or series get. You know, I want some of that resourcing to go to a broader variety of topics and, most importantly, tones. It really feels like there's a sharp delineation between what kinds of tones are allowed in different types of media. And, like, I wish that lighter-hearted tones or whatever, things that are just more relatable. Like, I personally have been divorced. I don't really need to watch another movie about a sad protagonist leaning against a kitchen counter contemplating their divorce.
But he's a metaphor about the director and his actual very famous divorce.
The alter ego of the director.
Yes. Yeah, it's a really culturally conformist time, which I think is kind of a hard thing to explain because the narrative is so much a narrative of, well, you just create a piece of art and you put it out there. You know, you could go a traditional publishing route or a traditional, like, filmmaking route, or you could put it on YouTube or something. But, like, there are just all of these ways that you can express yourself and people will recognize your talent. And that's, like, not at all how anything works at all. And I think that's part of why people get really tripped up and really upset about literature and whether or not it's, like, for them or it's good. It's because, like, it seems weird that so much mediocre stuff is, like, out there. And I think people are trying to make sense of it in a way that doesn't, like, indict the whole system they live in. So they, like, get very mad at individual writers or individual creators of some kind rather than, like, trying to, like, look at holistically, like, why is everything so fucked? Like, why are so many YA novelists, like, striving so hard, you know, things like that. Or I'm trying to think of another, like, really good example, like, just any kind of example of, like, why people are unsuccessful. You know, you can make a really funny TikTok and nobody watches it. And, like, people are, like, trying to, like, come up with, like, a grand unified theory, and it's like, oh, I'm being discriminated against for, like, maybe an identity thing. And it could be true. But it also could be that, like, it's just not a society that is actually interested in talent. It's interested in, like, what could be sold. And it's specifically, what do people who package and sell things think can be packaged and sold? They're looking for that knitting package that they can put by the register. They're not looking for something that's really good. They're not looking for something that has, like, full of mythos and is really original and really interesting. It just, does it fit next to the register? And will it maybe, again, not even certainly, but will it maybe move items?
And move items in the very specific category, the way that they have chosen to create these categories. So one thing I thought of earlier that I didn't say was Stephen King's book about writing called On Writing. He mentions that in a circle of other, you know, kind of best-selling authors that in interviews, nobody ever asks Stephen King about the language that he uses, because that's solely the domain of the literary fiction writers. They're the ones who are putting out real art, whereas Stephen King is putting out entertainment because it's popular and it doesn't have that same sort of tone. And this is another example of, I think, the kind of meta logos, where we have to put everything into these boxes and make it explainable. And literary fiction is where, like, the mythos is allowed to happen, and everywhere else is just people who are, like, churning out content.
Yeah. And it's not the and same that's crazy art. Because, like, Stephen King, like there are things he's better at writing at and things that he's not as good writing at, but they're like, some of his scenes are like, so you can visualize them so much in a way that you can't necessarily with certain, like, even well-praised literary writers. And there, you know, there are themes like Stephen King's It. You do not need to have like a PhD in literary analysis to understand that is a book about trauma, right? Like, that, like, these books have meaning in them.
Yeah, it's just really funny how we sort the types of media into these boxes, and then we as the audience are sort of further reinforce this by the kinds of demystification videos that we put out and what we choose to focus them on. It's crazy.
Yasmin and I have talked about doing a full Stephen King episode. I think this might be a good stay tuned for that, because we will do it at some point.
Unfortunately, I cannot participate. I have read his book about writing, but I have not read any of his books.
Really?
I know. I keep getting told. I have like three. I think I have tried to start with maybe the wrong books first, but like I've read the first chapter of Misery so many times.
Oh yeah, that one's a tough one. I'll make you a short list. I can make the audience a short list too. Yeah, Stephen King is a wonderful writer.
I was forced to watch the It movies, and I can agree with Aisling on that now because of the movies. Oh, yeah. I am forever scarred. I will never watch them again.
Tim Curry, not Gull Curry. But yeah, the opening line of Stephen King's The Dark Tower books, the man in black fled across the desert and the gunslinger followed. It's like, it's one of the great lines. Like, it's such a good opening line. He's just, oh, he's so good.
Yeah, I want to read that now.
Dark Tower, it goes disappointing places. But the first four are, like, just really incredible. Yeah, he has a really, like, that's some of his, the real breadth of his imagination and what he can do. Because he can do, like, horror and slightly more classic things, but he can do some really original, interesting stuff. The thing I get upset about is when people say that there are no good books being written anymore, there's no good art anymore. There is. You just have to do some work to get to it. Not even necessarily that much work, because, like, sometimes there are some things that are out there that are extremely good, that are extremely popular, like Elena Ferrante's novels, for example. There is a lot of really good stuff out there, but this is a really weird time, and people talk about things in really weird ways. People talk about Elena Ferrante in really weird ways. Like, the opening quote on the front of her first book is, like, "What if Jane Austen got angry?" That's what this book is, something like that.
Ugh.
Yeah, no, for real. It is for real that. If I lent it to a friend, or I'd show you. But yeah, again, that is like,
it's the Uber of literary fiction.
But that's like, again, it's like they're just trying to market. They're like, it's about ladies. I guess it's like Jane Austen. Like, that's like the level of depth you're getting out of,
like,
the publishing industry.
What thing that people already know and understand can we just make a direct comparison for, so that your brain is prepped to receive that, exactly that thing? Whereas, like, how would you do the same thing for Petscop? It's like, I want to read and watch things that are actually difficult to explain, because my brain is not, like, the perfect receptacle ready to receive a clone of art I've already seen.
Like, that's where the conflict comes in, right? Because if you're working at a publishing house, like, you don't want to see a thing that's like, I can't really explain it, but I promise you it's, like, really good and stuff. You want to see, like, it's like this popular thing, but with zombies or whatever. Like, you want something that you can sell.
And I think one thing that's helped me break away from some of these kinds of, you know, potentially troubling trends that we've talked about is the more that I consume media made in other cultures, you know, this sounds like a really obvious thing, but to Aisling's point about the tension of consuming media that wasn't necessarily intended for you, but it's a really joyful experience to, you know, try and embrace things that are actually hard. It's a little embarrassing sometimes to realize that this is a really mainstream thing in another country, and yet I'm really struggling to articulate to someone what it is. And I think that's a really good sign that you should continue to pursue that. You know, people who have never seen a slice of life anime show are,
yes,
like, actually probably very confused when they're watching it. They're like, what is it? What's the point? Like, how do I anticipate what's going to happen, because they haven't seen a lot of it? And that applies to all kinds of the you know, the Chinese entertainment, the C dramas that I've been watching. And then there's the really weird stuff. Like, if you then go from the mainstream things from other culture down a level, if I tried to explain Funky Forest to anyone, I don't even know what I would say. Like, Google Funky Forest, watch some of the YouTube videos. It's insane, but it's also like a really wonderful thing that is now in my brain forever.
Yes, I was thinking recently about Cardcaptors. Did you guys watch Cardcaptors? No.
No.
I'm too old for that.
I don't even know what that is.
No! So it was an anime. So it was originally done by this manga writing collective called Clamp in Japan, who made basically things that were kind of aimed or about like middle to high school girls. It's about a magical girl who finds like this book of cards that have like spirits inside them, and then she accidentally like sets all the cards free, and so then she has to like go around like capturing the spirits and stuff. And it got sold to the US and was on like Western TV in the late 90s, early 2000s, kind of around the same time, I guess, as like Pokemon Digimon, maybe Yu-Gi-Oh. But it had to be sold as something within those genres and also as something that would appeal to boys. So there's like the main character is a girl, but there is like a boy who's in it for some episodes. And they basically like bought all the episodes that had the boy in it, and they put those so that they were more like equal characters rather than he was a side character. There were loads of slice of life episodes because they would have like these monster fighting scenes, but they would also have entire episodes that had no monsters in them at all. It was just like she goes to a cafe and eats a slice of cake, right? Because that's a thing that you can do in Japan. You can have an episode where someone just goes to a place and eats some cake.
You can have a coffee shop AU in your own show. Yeah.
Yeah. And they didn't air any of those episodes. They put them in different orders. They took some gay shit out of it.
Oh!
Yeah. Yeah. And it became a completely different thing. So, yeah. But you can watch Slice of Life stuff is actually like really... really good. I like Samurai
Gorms. It's really
Gorms.
The only way to not be problematic, I'm going to be honest.
Yeah. You guys watched Samurai Gourmet?
No. I haven't.
It's a show about a guy who's retired. He's just retired. So he's like, what do I do with my time now? And he goes and he has lunch. That's the whole show. He's just a guy who goes and has lunch. It's hell so yeah. good.
Well, see, that's like, I love The Devil as a Part-Timer, which is literally about like the devil has lost his powers and he has to work at McRonald's. And that's it. And like one of my cats is named Chiana, which is actually a nerdy Farscape reference, but I call her Chiho a lot because there's a character in The Devil as a Part-Timer called Chiho and I love her.
Slice of Life anime is what autofiction is trying to be, but it's like too selfish and conceited. Because it's too much about the creator. But yeah, it should be about like a character just kind of doing things.
And,
like,
slapping the table, we've solved it. We've cracked the case. Now I'm going to go look up whether or not Sailor Moon got all fucked up like that. Like, did I watch the wrong Sailor Moon?
Oh, it super did. Oh. They cut out the gay stuff. They messed with it a lot. But yeah, it's really a repressive culture. We don't even know.
I really feel like we unlocked a lot of secrets of the universe today, guys.
Yeah, we solved it. It's... more books about lunch. I think that's where we ended up.
Yes.
I feel like we had kind of a wide-ranging conversation, but I think that's the ultimate takeaway. It's the ultimate carryout.
You should read Aisling's article, Satanic Panics and the Death of Mythos, though. A lot of really, really good individual sentences in here, actually. Speaking of the language, nobody ever asks the current affairs staff about the language of the articles. and going through all of these ideas. Actually, I recommend reading all of Aisling's archive.
Yeah, Aisling is brilliant. Aww. Like one of the best writers out there right now.
That's and I think Aisling. One of the actually wow. I'm going to tie it all together, guys. Are you ready?
Yes.
Ready. One thing that makes Aisling's articles so great is some of them are hard to explain in advance. So we have a nuclear semiotics one, and I've sent that to a bunch of my friends and been like, just read it. Like, I know you might think that you don't care about this subject, but it touches on so many things and weaves together a lot of stuff, and I'm like, it's hard to explain, but that's what makes it really beautiful. Are you wowed? Did I wow you?
I'm wowed.
I can't really be wowed because it's about me, so I can only feel sort of weird and distanced from it.
Are you blushing?
I might be, but I'm quite grumpy. All right. So, with that, I guess we shall say goodbye to Amusements and Managing Editor Leida Gold.
Bye.
Head Business Manager in Charge Allegra Silvans.
Peace out.
And me, Ashley McRae. Good night.